Hi, I'm Greg Schaefer, and welcome to the virtual CISO moment. Nick Oles joins us today. He is an author, cybersecurity professional, and veteran. Nick, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Greg. Really excited to chat with you today and be on the podcast.
We'd love to hear your journey, starting from why you got into this whole wonderful field of cybersecurity and what led you to where you're at today, including being a published author.
Yeah, so I had somewhat of a traditional path into cybersecurity. I grew up loving technology and helping people out, and that's kind of still my core, driver and motivator. But my first job, even in college, I worked on a help desk at my university, and I really, really took off, and I loved that position because it gave me exposure to a lot of different parts of information technology. I was working with, the server individuals, the people that were responsible for networking, wireless, security, audio visual, like things that you wouldn't really interact with if you had just one of those roles. And I was helping customers a lot of times solve problems, like password resets and application issues, networking issues, security issues, and stuff like that.
I frequently tell folks that working at a university while you're a student there is such a great path for exactly the reasons. I'm sorry for interrupting, but for exactly the reasons you just said, you get valuable experience that you can't get anywhere else. And of course, I say that because that's how I started as well, too. So go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely spot on. Like a university is like its own city when you think about it. They have their own police. A lot of times they have like fire emergency personnel. They've got
healthcare,
utilities, like academic environments, libraries, like recreational areas with the dorms and stuff like that. So yeah, tons of exposure to different things. It's really a fun place to work. And at the time, we would also see a lot of security issues on computers. So people would bring their computer to us and say, hey, I have a virus on my computer for whatever reason. And we would, we had this whole process of, we would run these different programs to try and remove it and go through this playbook or SOP process that, the leadership had made. And then at the end of the day, if it didn't work, we would just reimage the machine or ask them to reimage the machine and we would help them restore whatever files we could. But that was kind of my first exposure to security. And I would have people come to us with this laptop, it was always like a Friday afternoon or like right before finals, they're working on this research paper and they have this virus that locks everything up and you're, really trying to like save the day and, get their files back. And that's what I loved that. I loved helping people out and understanding, what these problems were and how we could fix them and how we can help them in the future and kind of tell them, hey, this is probably what happened. Or if you saw an email like this, it wasn't good. And that kind of got me into my first career. I really liked the networking side of information technology. So my very first full-time job was working as a network administrator and running through all the different scenarios of how to set up a new network and how to integrate wireless and how to expand. I was working at a small business and we would move offices all the time and things like that. And it was fascinating. And that kind of parlayed me into more of a full-time security role. So we started deploying more security software. We purchased an antivirus suite and, that was managed over the network. So because I was the network guy, that fell under my purview. So I started doing antivirus first, and then we would additionally still clean up viruses, kind of like what I was doing on the help desk. And I still remember to this day, the first incident that really like pivoted me into cybersecurity. I had a user come to us. They were a sales individual, which, I love salespeople, but they were a lot of our issues with security and files and stuff like that we were always trying to restore. But this salesperson came to me and was like, hey, my computer's completely locked. I can't do anything. I've got this really important proposal that I need to push out in the next couple of days. Can you help me out with that? And we're like, yeah, I'm sure it's just something minor. And they had this screen that went over their screen once the computer booted up. And it was just like a pop-up basically that you couldn't get to go away. And it said like, hey, this is the FBI. We've seized all your files. You can't get anything back unless you pay us this fee through Western Union or MoneyGram. And I was like, there's no way. I mean, I just couldn't fathom the FBI taking a payment through Western Union. Like, I'm like, there's no way. And we looked into it some more. And again, this is like kind of early 2000s timeframe. So everything wasn't as prominent as it is now, as far as like ransomware and attacks and stuff like that. And what I had looked up at the time is it was like ad ransomware at the time. You know, it was an early version of ransomware where the files weren't actually locked. It was more of like a, you couldn't use the system until this was removed. And I thought that was fascinating. And I kind of wanted to help people, you know, stop criminal organizations or bad people from doing this to victims. And that's when I kind of pivoted into to more of security type work. And I ended up eventually joining the military early on in my career as well, and serving in a reserve component. Doing that as well, starting out initially kind of a very similar path as how I got into security, as a regular IT communications manager, pivoted into cybersecurity, and was fortunate enough to kind of do that in tandem with my civilian careers. And it's been an awesome ride, awesome journey the whole time. Have been able to pivot and benefit from both careers while serving in the military.
Well, just from that standpoint, what do you feel, how do you feel that being in the military has affected your career? I'm looking more at what are some of the benefits of like your military experience carried over into cybersecurity?
Yeah, so there's a lot of benefits initially. So, you know, initially just the character traits that you pick up in the military. I know you were in the military as well, but just, you know, the discipline, the attention to detail, the following a chain of command, following orders and stuff. That stuff's all great. And, you know, that I think that helps make, you know, a good professional, a good security personnel, a good IT worker, just a good person in general, to be honest. But also, you know, the training has been phenomenal. I've received a lot of really good government funded training. I've received a lot of industry training through the government. That's really helped me out a lot. But it's just having that mindset, you know, of learning tactics in the military of, you know, offensive and defensive stuff, and maybe not 100% to cybersecurity, but applying that to cybersecurity. So understanding, you know, how to defend something, how to attack something, especially early on in the military, in, you know, using conventional forces or stuff like that. And then you transition that over that. And instead of, you know, me defending a bridge or a tower or something like that, I'm defending an organization or a server or a file, and just evaluating kind of like red teaming, like evaluating what ways would I come in? What ways would I target this? What are my weak points? What are my strong points? And how can I use those to my advantage? And the military does a great job of exposing you to things early on, quickly, learning things rapidly. And I think it's a great jumpstart, you know, to your career, to breaking into cyber, because you get that, you know, you get that initial training right away, then you get thrown right into a job, you get a couple years of experience, and then you know, you make a decision to either stay in the military or transition out or get into a reserve component. But it's been a phenomenal ride for me.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. The experience that you can gain, you know, we just talked about the university experience, and then also from the military. A lot of times people ask, again, how do I get into cyber? Well, those are two prime examples. It doesn't mean you have to follow that path, but I try to use those examples myself. Like, you know, my Air Force days, I didn't do anything technology related. I was a mechanic, but the person who first hired me from my first part-time job at the university as a network tech basically said, well, if you can read a technical order to fix C-130s, airplanes, you can probably figure out this networking stuff. I'm like, well, he was right. Here I am 34 years later. So, I mean, good advice to folks. It's just like always look to where you can get exposure to multiple areas of the field you're trying to get it to. And I think it transcends cyber as well. Like to ask though, now you've obviously had a varied career, and you've seen a lot. What would you think is one of the more significant threats today to small and mid-sized businesses, cybersecurity?
Yeah. So, I think phishing is one of the biggest threats, you know, that small and medium businesses face. It's been around for a long time. It's been very prominent in the industry. And it's not going away. You know, attackers are always going to use the easiest method they can to get in. And phishing is one of the lowest cost barriers to enter. It's very prevalent. Everyone has email. Every organization is using some sort of electronic messaging system. And the attacks are very wide ranged. So I think that's one of the biggest threats to small and medium businesses. And one of the issues with that is that we don't do a good job as an industry, and SM small and medium businesses do a good job at training their individuals on.
Well, how can you catch a fish?
That's a great question. So
that's a softball question, by the way.
Yeah. So this is a plug. I was able to write this book last year. It's called How to Catch a Fish. And I wrote this because I was on an information security team, very senior organization, very large, and we didn't have any formal process to identify phishing emails. And this was us on the security staff. But, you know, we required our users to watch these videos like everyone does. And, you know, they do some good things. And you can learn some stuff through videos and games and stuff like that. But the actual process of looking at an email, identifying the indicators, were something that I wasn't seeing. And just like looking at things like the greeting, the content, the attachments, do the attachments make sense? The links, like link hovering, just very simple, basic stuff like that. A lot of people don't have that ability or that training or that knowledge. And they're afraid of it. And it's if you have some of these core basic skills and you master, you know, the basics, you can help protect yourself and your organization from a large number of threats related to phishing emails. And also, like, non-technical individuals. That was another reason why I got into this book writing, is people like your relatives, your grandma, your mother, your aunt, your uncle, your cousin, that might not have a technical background. They might not want to get into tech stuff. They all have email accounts too, and they all fall victims, unfortunately, to scams like this too. So the reason why I wanted to write this book was something for a very wide audience could pick it up with no technical background or very little technical background and understand basic components of how to identify suspicious parts of an email and get you to a better understanding of what would make this, you know, a legitimate or a malicious email. And some free basic open source tools that can help anyone from, like I said, the organization level in a professional environment to a person that's using a free Gmail account or something like that, that just gets spam emails or malicious emails throughout their day.
Well, now I got to ask you a question, only because you mentioned Gmail, and this goes back to a LinkedIn post, the poll that I actually have going active right now. I think it'd still be active when this airs. The question is, if you see that someone has, like, a business is proposing something to you and that they have a Gmail or other free account, is that something that bothers you, and if or not? And if so, does it bother you because it looks unprofessional or that it's a potential security threat like you were just talking about?
It would heighten my awareness. I would say that much. So it depends on, you know, what's normal for that business. Like, are they a startup? Are they in the very early stages? If they're a very, like, well-established organization and they're still using, like, a free Gmail account, yeah, I would be extremely suspicious. If it's a very small, you know, one man or one woman shop, I wouldn't be that suspicious. So it just kind of depend on, you know, what's normal. Or if I don't know what's normal, then yes, it might be a little bit of a sign of maybe a potential suspicious indicator. And one of the things that I try and talk about in my book that I think everyone should do is, you know, there's no one indicator that can solely tell if an email is good or bad. It's got to be kind of like the totality of a few different things that you're looking at for you to come up with that decision of whether an email is good or bad. And that's, it takes experience. It takes time. Sometimes it takes tools. Sometimes it doesn't. And that's what you kind of have to take a step back and look at when you're evaluating these emails. So I guess to answer that, you know, out of the gate, no, I wouldn't say that it's 100% bad every time, or I wouldn't say every email that comes from a free email provider is suspicious, but I would take that into consideration when evaluating, you know,
so,
an email.
So that's part of the whole ecosystem, but now it gets to be a lot harder now that I can go to, like, say, ChatGPT, and I'm like, please create a phishing email for me to try to get Nichols' Office 365 credentials. And boom, there it is. And I send it to you. So in the era of where now we used to say that, and this is still applicable, don't get me wrong, but, you know, look for spelling errors, that sort of thing, grammar errors.
Yeah.
But you kind of touched on something, and I think this is probably where you're going to go with this, that you look at the totality of the email that, I mean, what do we do with regards to, like, an AI generated email? One of the things I would think of is that if you know the person's style, for example, that's hard to replicate, but even that's not completely out of the ordinary. So what are they to do? What can we do?
Yeah, so absolutely. That's a great question. That is one thing that I think we'll continue seeing in the future, you know, is better crafted emails using tools like ChatGPT. Because like you said, yes, you can give ChatGPT or some AI platform a sample of writing and say, use this as a sample, write me a phishing email based off this. And it will use that context that it can to replicate it. But I think knowing what's normal is still a very relevant factor. So a simple thing like, my name is Nick. If someone writes me an email that says Nicholas in my greeting, that's kind of a sign for me. It's like they might not know me, or maybe that's just like a cold email, stuff like that. That's not something ChatGPT or any AI platform is really going to pick up on it if you tell them. So subtle things like that, or the way that I use a specific term, or the way I speak and stuff like that, or would I expect someone to explain something to me in that manner. Those that additional context, it's a little bit harder than, you know, just picking out a grammatical error or the wrong use of there or something like that. That's super easy. So I think it's just paying a little bit closer attention, understanding your people, and then verifying things. So if you're not sure, and this is one thing I cover in my book a little bit, you know, if I get a suspicious email from someone and it says, hey, click on this link, sign up for this, and I'm not sure, and it's got, you know, a signature at the bottom with their phone number, their office address and stuff like that. I always try and encourage people, you know, verify this activity with another form of communication. So I'm not going to use the phone number that's in their email signature because anyone can make that up. But I might look up online, you know, what the address of this business is or this organization or this individual, find a number from a trusted known source. Maybe that's, you know, the internet or a phone book or some promotional flyer I got from the organization. And then I might call them and say, hey, I'm looking to talk to John Doe. I got this business proposal. It seems a little odd. Can I verify that? Or my bank, you know, that's a great example. Like I might call my local branch or go down there, you know, if it's right down the street and just be like, hey, I got this email. It's very odd. Do you guys really need this information? And maybe they'll say yes, maybe no.
Well, and you talked about like take the time to really look at it, but that's another thing that the bad actors do, that they're going to try sometimes to make it imperative that you have to respond right now. And that's another, that would be another thing to look for, right? The sense of urgency.
Oh, sense of urgency is huge. Yeah. That's absolutely a tactic that's used. You know, we'll see things like an email account is going to expire. You have to action this in 1 hour, 24 hours, whatever. It doesn't really matter what the time frame is. It's just, it's been shown that psychologically, if we're given a time frame, we operate poorly under that, you know, designated time frame because we don't want to miss out. So if you do anything at all, really, I mean, this could be not even related to cybersecurity or technology. Like if there's a clock running down while you're trying to do that task, you're most likely going to perform poorly on it. Just from that, you know, sense of urgency, anxiety, you know, fear of it running out. So that's absolutely a tactic that attackers use all the time, is an adverse action tied to, you know, a designated time period that's arbitrary, really. They've made it up because usually nothing's really going to happen if you miss that time hack.
So lots of great information. I mean, we covered so much in like less than 10 minutes on that. The totality of the email, the source address, the tone, the timing and all of that. I love the fact, too, that you've written this book from basically starting from your experiences. You were trying to solve an issue that you had. You didn't have the procedures down at that point in time. And ultimately, that's where the best giving back to the community comes from. It's trying to solve a problem and then not only solving it in your own environment, but making it available to other folks. So I appreciate you doing that, but I have to ask, how can somebody get a copy of your book?
Yeah, so it's available on Amazon. So if you just go to amazon.com, you search How to Catch a Fish, you can get it all over the world. I also, it's published through A-Press, so they have a website too. You can get it through apress.com. Amazon's usually, you know, the easiest, most known way. I also, am very active on LinkedIn. You can find me on LinkedIn, add me. I would love to hear, you know, about your journey, about your process for phishing. I do have some free copies that I can give out to select individuals. But those are usually the best ways to get my book.
Maybe we can do like a little promo where it's like, mention the virtual CISO moment and you get a free copy, something like that.
Yeah, I would definitely be open to that. I'm all about, you know, helping others, helping people protect themselves and their organization. That's kind of why I went down this path of writing a book, and that's why I'm still in this industry, because I really like helping people secure their organization. I like stopping hackers and criminals and bad people from doing bad things to good people. So absolutely, I'd be interested in that.
It's great to have that passion, and that passion definitely is one of those things that can help to keep at bay a little bit the stresses associated with our industry. But the point it though is that we are in a stressful industry, and sometimes it's part of the reason is because it always seems like that there's never a point that we can actually say that we've won the war. We win little battles here and there, but then something else happens and we get knocked back, and we just keep on pushing, keep on trying because of passion. But at some point in time, you need to take a step back and take care of yourself and really decompress. So Nick, what's one of the things that you do to help decompress from the stresses of cyber?
Yeah, so I try and dedicate time where I'm not in front of a screen, first and foremost. So there'll be times where I'm going to, you know, read a book, an actual book, not like on a Kindle or a tablet or anything like that, but something, you know, not in front of the TV, not in front of my phone or my laptop, just try and dedicate some time, ideally every day, just to doing something like that, something I enjoy. And the book topics could be all over the board. I usually try and read something cybersecurity related, but a lot of times it's something unrelated to get my mind off something else. I also, exercise is a major component of my life. So I'm one of the few, I think, IT people that enjoy running. I like being outside and exercising and pushing myself in that regard. But I enjoy running. It's one of my favorite pastimes. So that's another thing that I'll do just to get my mind out, get some calm, quiet, you know, just peace, I guess.
What's your, I'm assuming you've participated in runs as part of that, but yep. Right. So what's your favorite distance?
Oh, so 2 to 3 miles is my ideal distance right now. It used to be a lot longer. You know, I've done the halves and the fulls and the 5Ks and stuff, but on my own, I really enjoy that 2 to 3 mile time frame, kind of at a slow, I call it like a slog, a slow jog pace. That's ideal for me.
Yeah. As I've gotten older, because I've done some halves and fulls, I don't think I have a full left in me ever again. Last one was the 2017, I think. But, you know, I think one of the hardest things that I've had to come to grip with is, if I do 3 miles at 11 and a half minute pace now, it's like, that's good for me. That's a good run. I'm out, I'm enjoying nature and all that.
Yeah.
And you're talking to someone who 10 years ago or 15 years ago, I'd be doing that at an 8 minute pace. So it's like, I mean, there's just certain things that, I mean, obviously I still like to run as well too. I think running is like a really great way to decompress because, again, you're out in nature, you're breathing fresh air. Yep. And after, at least for me, and you may or may not agree, but for me, it's like after about the first mile, maybe a little bit more, that's when the endorphins really kick in. And it's like, ah, this is great. But if you go past 3 or 4, and sometimes I do longer runs, but you know, that's when the pain starts to creep in with all sorts of things, feet, knees, and all that. So,
oh, absolutely. And like the repetition is huge on running. You know, like if I didn't run for 6 months or a year and then I went running, it would be horrible, just like anyone else. Yeah. But if you're doing it like regularly and you build up that like stamina and your body's used to it a little bit, you're absolutely right. You know, after that first mile, you loosen up, you feel a little bit better, you enjoy it for that next mile, and then when you start to get to that third mile, that's, I'm with you, I start to kind of tap out a little bit. But yeah, great way to decompress and get away and kind of take some time for yourself.
Now people got to understand that the they have those programs from couch potato to 5K. That doesn't mean doing that in the same day. It's like you got to build up to it. So it's just like, you know, baby steps literally at that point in time. Well, yeah. Nick, what else you got planned coming up? You got any plans to write another book or maybe enhance the edition of this book or maybe turn it into a movie or something?
Yeah, so that is something, you know, quickly when I wrote this book, I realized, you know, this is really good for this snapshot in time right now, but phishing attacks and technologies change rapidly. It's going to have to be an enduring thing. So that is something I'm entertaining in the future, doing, you know, a second edition or another version, you know, to cover new phishing attacks that are coming through, new technologies that are now available, and, you know, all the graphical user interfaces and stuff like that, those change over time. So just giving that, you know, a fresh update, but that might be in the next year or two. I still really love helping people out, helping people manage risk and being in leadership roles in the information technology and cybersecurity space. So that's also something I like to work in tandem with that as well. So I'm in that field and that space and still doing, you know, my military stuff as well. So staying busy, that's for sure.
That's awesome. The book is How to Catch a Fish, a practical guide to detecting phishing emails. You can get it on Amazon and other places where good books are sold. Nick, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate your time. Fascinating stuff.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks for having me, Greg. Really appreciate it.
And everybody, stay secure.